spirit of forgiveness, I hope you'll just indulge the slight tardiness here, and my thanks to whoever left those books outside for softening the lateness. So we are Bekesel Osor, and of course, so much to say that I think the only real danger is trying to say everything at once. we often begin with a matter of halacha or minhag that relates to the day before moving on to matters more of machshava. What's very interesting about the halachic question here, or minhagic question, is that it is of the nature such that it's possible that people do not even realize that it is a question. So much has it insinuated itself into the fabric of the day, we may never have known that there is what to talk about. But there is. As we enter Yom Kippur, so we light lights with a bracha, and the nusach of the bracha is Asher kedushanu b'mitzvoso b'tzivanu lahadlik ner shel Yom HaKippurim. Now, on the one hand, it is Yom Kippur, but it's a very unusual nusach, because we are familiar with essentially 2 days of candle lighting, Shabbos and Yom Tov. And when it's Shabbos, we say Lahadlik Ner Shel Shabbos. And when it's Yom Tov, we say Lahadlik Ner Shel Yom Tov. Now Yom Kippur somehow received its own nusach. We don't say Lahadlik Ner Shel Chag HaMatzos or Lahadlik Ner Shel Rosh Hashanah or Yom HaZikaron. So in a sense, how is it that Yom Kippur came to get its own mention? We mention it by name, Lahadlik Ner Shel Yom HaKippurim. And the Chasam Sofer states, perhaps in a somewhat straightforward manner, that Yom Kippur doesn't really fit into any of the other categories, in the sense that it's not Shabbos. The Torah calls it Shabbos Shabboso, but it's not Shabbos in the classic sense. And it's also not Yom Tov, certainly in the way that we are familiar with other Yomim Tovim. It really is a category all of its own. Interestingly, it is called a Yom Tov in the Mishnah, and in fact, the Mishnah says it was one of the greatest Yomim Tovim that we ever had. Lo hayu Yomim Tovim li Yisrael ela ki Yom Kippurim v'ketuv ba'av. So it's called Yom Tov, but not in that way, not in the halachic Yom Tov way, but just in the fact that it was an amazing day. So it was a Yom Tov, but it wasn't a Yom Tov, and therefore, it really is an entity unto itself, and that's why it gets its own bracha of Lahadlik Ner Shel Yom HaKippurim. It's not this, and it's not that. It's its own thing, Yom HaKippurim. There's no other way you can refer to it. But perhaps there is somewhat more. The truth is, and here is the surprise for those of us that perhaps may not have known, it's not entirely straightforward that one lights before Yom Kippur at all. In fact, the Mishnah informs us, this is in the fourth parak of Maseches Pesachim, that lighting lights before Yom Kippur is a matter of minhag. And some people had the minhag, and other people didn't. And that's in the chapter which is called Mokam Shenagu. And in a place where the minhag is like this, they would do like this, and if not that way, then not that way. Mokam Shenagu lahadlik ner b'yom ha-kippurim. Madlikim. If you live in a place where that's the minhag, good, do so. And no, then no. So amazingly, there were two different minhagim, and depending on where you lived, you either would or wouldn't light lights. But the question is, what's behind these two minhagim? I mean, in a sense, why is it different than any other Yom Tov? So this question is discussed by the Radvaz in one of his tshuvas, the great Rabbi David ben Zamra, prolific author of tshuvas. And he explains that the minhag, yes, to light, and the minhag, not to light, it's not just, quote-unquote, two minhagim, but it actually represents two different approaches to what Shabbos lights and Yom Tov lights are about in the first place. And by that we mean, there are two aspects to Shabbos and Yom Tov. There is the aspect of kavod, right, to give honor to Shabbos and Yom Tov, and that we do by wearing special clothes and etc. And then there's onik, enjoyment. And enjoyment takes the form of the su'udos. And Shabbos has both, and Yom Tov had both. And there is a mitzvah, Lahadlik Ner. And the question is, to which branch of Shabbos and Yom Tov does the mitzvah of Hadlakas HaNer partake or accrue? Does it belong to the category of covered Shabbos and covered Yom Tov? After all, it does give covered, right? You light lights, Bechubad. Or is it perhaps Oneg? After all, you cannot compare a person having their Shabbos Suda in the dark as having a Shabbos Suda where they can see. And therefore, perhaps it belongs to the branch of Oneg. Generally, it doesn't matter because you have both. So it's a scholar's debate, and you can talk about it as you're enjoying your Shabbos meal, as to whether you lit lights to give kovod to Shabbos or as part of Oneg Shabbos, kovod Yom Tov or Oneg Yom Tov. However, it will come to a fore on Yom Kippur, because Yom Kippur has a mitzvah of kovod. In fact, the pasuk v'chibadato, if I'm not mistaken, is in the Haftarah of Yom Kippur. V'chibadato, we wear Yom Tov clothes, etc. There's a mitzvah of kovod for Yom Tov, but there's no mitzvah of oneg. I think that's, to put it mildly, the mitzvah of the day is inui. Is in its own way the opposite. So now the question is, so should you light lights? It really depends on where the mitzvah of lighting lights comes from. If it comes from kovod, you should, because there's kovod for Yom Kippur. If it's from oneg, no need, because there's no oneg on Yom Kippur. You're not going to enjoy the Yom Kippur fast by candlelight. And so the Radvaz says this is the source of these two different minhagim. Those that lit understood that it's because of kovod, and therefore Yom Kippur is kovod. And those that did not light, shenagu lo lahadlik, understood that it derived from the mitzvah of oneg. And those are the two minhagim. Our minhag is to light. As far as I'm not aware of any community nowadays where there's a minhag not to light on Yom Kippur. Our minhag is to light. But it's important to realize that it's a minhag. It's a matter of minhag. Which means, seemingly, that when we make a bracha, lahadlik ner, on this minhag, it then opens up the question generally of making a bracha on minhagim. Which, as we may know, there are different opinions about that. Sfardim tend not to want to make brachas on minhagim. Ashkenazim, more yes so. But somehow this minhag, not only is it, did it become universal, but it chaps a bracha also, and that is that presents us with what we call the mitzvah, which is essentially the minhag of hadlakas ner on Yom Kippur, with the bracha. Says Rav Itzhak Zolti, after all that, once you've seen the journey of the mitzvah of or the minhag of lighting lights on Yom Kippur, we understand why it has its own nusach for the bracha, because it isn't part of the mitzvah generally of lahadlik ner shel Yom Tov, because there is no mitzvah in that way. It is a minhag, and we make a bracha as a minhag with its own nusach. Therefore, lahadlik ner shel Yom Kippur. So. That's something to ponder. One doesn't spend too much time looking at the lights on Yom Kippur, but as with everything else, there's background to it, and that is, those are the, if I may say, highlights of this minhag. Now, we spoke about the Mishnah, and the Mishnah says that there were no more wonderful days for the Jewish people like Tu B'Av and Yom Kippur. Tu B'Av will have to leave for a different time. The matter at hand is Yom Kippur, and that's a Mishnah in Maseches Tanis towards the end. And the Gemara elaborates as to what was the great simcha of Yom Kippur. And the Gemara says Yom Kippur was a day of outstanding simcha for two reasons. One of them we could intuit ourselves and we will readily identify with. The other one perhaps less so. What are these two reasons? Says the Gemara, number one, that was the day that we received Slicha and Kapara, which is good enough reason to rejoice as any, better, in fact, than most. That's the first thing. And secondly, says the Gemara, it was the day that we received the second Luchos, which we did, as we know. There was the three sets of 40 days, culminating in Moshe coming down with the Luchos, and they were given to him on Yom Kippur. and as I said, I think when we think of what's so important or impactful about Yom Kippur, we will certainly gravitate towards the first. For us, it's all about Slicha and Kapara. I don't think we focus on the fact that there was a second set of luchos given on Yom Kippur. I don't think it's mentioned anywhere in the Machzor, which is actually quite interesting because the Machzor has many things in it. But I haven't been through all the piyutim at the back, but the Gemara mentions this as one of the two primary aspects, and it just seems to be at the side, certainly in terms of our Yom Kippur experience. But it is worthwhile pondering for the fullness of understanding what is so important about the fact that we got the second set of luchos. Why does that make it such a happy day? What is its contribution? And moreover, what is its relationship with the fact that we got slicha and kapara? They have to be connected. It is inconceivable that these two incredible things just happen to land on the same day, which means that somehow the attainment of slicha and kapara on Yom Kippur is complemented by receiving the second set of luchos. And the question is, how does that work? What is the synergy between them? And the truth is that this question will really open up a number of other questions for us, very basic questions that I think it's very easy to go for a long time and never ask them about the luchos, because we know that there were luchos, we know what they looked like, even though the depiction on Shul is not that way, and we know roughly what was said on them, even though that's also machlokas, and we leave it at that. But it is worthwhile at some point opening the question, what was the role of the luchos? What did they do, if we may ask? It sounds like a non-question because they were just there. But what did they do? And to perhaps consolidate the question, we'd heard the Aseres HaDibros at Har Sinai. We would subsequently receive the entire Torah, all Chamisha Chumashim, with all Tarek Mitzvahs, which means that this record of the Aseres HaDibros, it's kind of neither here nor there. It is a written record of the Aseres HaDibros, but we heard them already, and in terms of written material, we had much, much more. And therefore, we do need to ask, what was the significance of the luchos? Why were they so important for us? And they were, and they reside in the Oran. Secondly, and again, these are somewhat deconstructive questions because these are things that we never really thought to ponder. Why are the Aseres HaDibros written on luchos? Why are they written on tablets of stone? And again, the background to the question here is, the rest of the Torah is not written on stone. The rest of the Torah is written on parchment. Now you can say, well, I don't need a whole Sefer Torah to write the Aseres HaDibros. That's true. You don't need the whole Sefer Torah to write a mezuzah. You just take a small piece of parchment and write what you need to write. Which means, if all that's different is the fact that it's the Aseres HaDibros as opposed to everything, so why does the medium change even as the content changes? Have a smaller scroll and write the Aseres HaDibros. How does from Torah to Aseres HaDibros also parallel from parchment to stone? Why are there luchos, in brief? Further, as we follow and we track the luchos, we find that when the luchos were broken on the 17th of Tammuz, and that becomes the first tragedy of the luchos, and it's not even the tragedy of the day is not even called the day that we made the Chet HaEgel or the day that we did whatever with the Chet HaEgel. It's called the day that the luchos were broken. It sounds like that was the worst thing that happened that day. Except once again, why was it so worse? Obviously, it's not nice for the luchos to be broken. It would be nicer to have them. But did anything change? Was it a tragic event for itself? Did it bring about a different course, or did it stop something from happening, or was it very simply, here's the luchos, we could have had them and we didn't have them, but we're not sure what difference it makes whether we have them or not? Fourthly, subsequently we did receive new luchos, and that brings us back to Yom Kippur. And again, the question is, so did we, the first were broken, then we just kind of got the, we got the luchos in the end. It just took a while. The first set were broken, then we got the second set, but in the end we got the luchos. But are they the same? as the first Luchos? Is everything exactly as it was? It's just the first one was aborted and the first one crashed and the second one needed to be restarted? Or is there a difference between the second Luchos and the first? And if there is, what is the difference and why does it make a difference? There is a, continuing our questions here, mitzvah ger is mitzvah. There is a well-known drasha in Pirkei Avos in the sixth perek, but the pasuk says that the writing was charus al aluchos, was engraved on the luchos. A michtav elokim hu charus al aluchos, charus engraved, and the Mishnah or the Brisa in the sixth perek of Pirkei Avos it does an al tikri. It tells us, read it not thus, but thus. Al tikri charus el acherus. Don't read engraved, read free. From which we get the famous formulation, ein lecha ben chorin ela misha osek b'talmud Torah. The only person who's a real cherus is a person who's involved in Talmud Torah. Now, the two pertinent questions to that very well-known drasha are, firstly, how is a person who's involved in learning Torah a ben chorin? I mean, clearly not in the conventional sense of the word. The more he learns, the more rules he discovers, the more he needs to abide by, and the learning itself is a commitment, which means that he certainly doesn't seem to lead the life of a ben chorin in the way that we normally picture it. And secondly, and in a sense equally importantly, we always need to be alert when we have these drushas of Chazal. Read not thus, but thus. Why are Chazal telling me not to read the Pasuk in the way that it's written, but rather in a somewhat different way? Al tikri halichos ela halochos. Al tikri banayich ela bonayich. Al tikri chorus ela chorus. I'd like to read a chorus. That's as the Pasuk intended. And is there perhaps, and is there a connection between the two? Because chorus means engraved, and chayrus means freedom. And as far as we're concerned, never the twain shall meet. I mean, they have no connection to each other. So then how is one, in a sense, almost the springboard or the launch for the other? Just because they have a lot of letters in common, but they have no essential affinity one for each other. So the direction that is given to us here from Chazal themselves with regards to the Luchos is that we need to appreciate and then develop the idea that the giving of the Luchos was an integral part, was its own part of Matan Torah. What that means to say is, giving the Luchos, it wasn't that the Torah had been given already, but here are the Luchos. Somehow, the giving of the Luchos is a stage in Matan Torah. It's a part of Matan Torah. How do we know this? Because the very same Mishnah which spoke in such glowing terms about Yom Kippur quotes the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, Tse'enu Re'ena, Bonos Yerushalayim, Ba'atara She'itra Lo Shlomo, B'yom Chasunaso, U'v'yom Simchas Libo. And leaving aside most of the pasuk, focusing on, as the Mishnah does, on the end, it refers to two times. Yom Chasunoso, the time of the wedding, or Yom Simchas Libo, a time of the joy of his heart. When are these days? When are these times? Says the Mishnah, Yom Chasunoso, Ze Matan Torah. That's the day of Matan Torah. And Yom Simchas Libo, the joy of his heart, that's when the Mishkan was set up. But leaving aside the Mishkan, we see that the Mishnah has adduced the term Yom Chasunoso and called it Ze Matan Torah. This is the giving of the Torah. We know the concept of Matan Torah. It's a very, very specific concept. And it attached it to the giving of the Luchos. That tells us that the giving of the Luchos was an integral part of the process called Matan Torah. Matan Torah, it began with the Aseres HaDibros at Sinai. That was part of Matan Torah. Receiving the Chumash ultimately was also part of Matan Torah. But then also receiving the Aseres HaDibros in Luchos form, is also part of Matan Torah. And that means that without the Luchos, the Torah is not fully given. You've heard the Aseres Hadibros, you've got the whole Torah scroll. But if you don't have the Aseres Hadibros on stone, the Torah is not fully given. They're part of the giving of the Torah. And the question is, how? The Medrash discusses the Luchos and asks our very question, why were the Aseres Hadibros written on Luchos? Lama nasanahem Luchos, says the Medrash, Lirmoz lahem, to allude to them, to the Jewish people, sheyichdevu divrei Torah al luach libam, that they should write, inscribe, engrave the words of Torah on the tablet of their heart. As the well-known pasuk says in Mishlei, kosveim al luach libecha, write them on the tablet of your heart. So what the Medrash is saying is that the what the Luchos are communicating is not so much, important to formulate it, not so much new Torah information. There is nothing written on the Luchos that will not be written in a Sefer Torah, and much, much more in the fullness of time. There isn't anything written on the Luchos that we hadn't heard already at Sinai. But what you have in the Luchos is, if one may say, and it was never truer, the medium is the message. Meaning, the medium upon which they are written, that's the message. The contribution or the role of the Aseres Hadibros within Matan Torah is not to give new content or new information, but it's to reflect the connection that we need to have with the words of Torah. There can be the entire world of Torah. It's out there, and we're here, and it's possible to study it, and to learn it, and to talk about it, but never be emotionally connected to it. It's possible for the words of Torah to reside within the mind. And it can be a formidable mind. And it can be discoursing at length, and over the course of many years. But never touches the heart. It's possible. And to that, the degree that that's possible, that means it's possible that the Torah is never fully given, because it's only considered given when it reaches the entire person. If it only reaches his mind, it's stopped halfway, and that is a partially delivered Torah. It has not been fully given, and has not been fully received. And that is why we say that the Luchos are now an integral contribution to Matan Torah. Not so much the words of Torah themselves, but to what degree did they need to be given? We have the Torah on the Torah scroll, but the matan of the Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, that's what the Luchos reflect. And what difference does it make, if we may ask? What is the difference between a person who the Torah has reached his mind alone, or the Torah has reached the whole person, not only cerebrally, but also emotionally, as represented by the Luchos? Well, let us return to our drasha in Pirkei Avos. It says that only a person who's involved in Torah is a Ben Chorin. And as we can appreciate, we need to examine that statement, because he has many rules and he's not free to do as he wants. What then is the meaning that the only one who is involved in Torah is a Ben Chorin? So as the Mefarshim point out, what it means is that if a person does not answer to a higher calling, if he doesn't subscribe to a higher accountability, he essentially is not free at all, because he's at the mercy. He's at the mercy of forces within himself, outside of himself, whether physical, emotional, societal, psychological, and the like. There's plenty of masters out there. And if a person doesn't have the lifeline of Torah through which to raise himself above all of those, and it's possible for him to be in control of them as opposed to them being in control of him, that is what we mean when we say that only a person who's osek in Torah, who's engaged and involved in Torah, is free from all of those things. But the question, of course, that we have to ask is that always true? anyone who learns Torah then becomes free from all these things. It would be nice if it was true. It is not the case. It is certainly possible for someone to be involved in Torah again extensively, but not necessarily that they're in control of anything. They're still a slave. So what is Pirkei Avos telling us? What Pirkei Avos is telling us is that there are two ways to learn Torah. And when it has this incredible formulation, whereby it says that if a person is engaged in Torah, he's a ben chorin, which derives from the word chairus, which is launched from the word chorus. And interestingly, this statement about a person who's involved in Torah, it's rooted in a pasuk about the luchos. The luchos, it says that Hashem's writing was chorus al luchos, engraved on the luchos. But do you have to be involved in the luchos in order to be free? You can't be involved in any other area of Torah? All areas of Torah. Yes. But it has to be in the way that the writing was put on the luchos. It has to be chorus. As if to say, it has to be engagement in Torah, involvement in Torah, in the way that the luchos bespeak and represent, namely, engraved on the heart. Now, says Pirkei Avos, go and see, and you will see. A person whose Torah messages and Torah ideas and ideals are engraved on their heart, that's a person who has a higher calling. That's a person who will rise above those other things. A person who learns Torah, and there's many other ways to learn Torah, and perhaps they're mitzvahs, some of them, but it's not engraved. If it's not chorus, there's no chairus, or there's no guarantee of chairus. That's for sure. The whole designation of what a person can become, the elevated person, that is subject to learning Torah in a chorus type of way. And then Maharal has a further chiddush. Maharal in the Sefer Tiferes Yisrael. So far we've stated, and it is the most profound statement, and I think it brings the whole concept of luchos really into a much more meaningful place for us. Otherwise, there's the two tablets, they live in the Aron, and Shalom al Yisrael. But says Maharal, the luchos not only reflect this level of what we call ben chorin, not only do they reflect someone who is an elevated personality, the giving of the luchos contributed and affected that level. Meaning, the Jewish people were in a different state prior to receiving the luchos and post. The message that's embodied in the luchos, that the Torah is engraved on the heart, and all that goes with that, the elevated living that goes with that, that was fully cemented when the Jewish people received the luchos. They enable, they're a catalyst which allow the Jewish people to enjoy that status. Prior to receiving the luchos are there, but the Jewish people haven't yet received them. That means they haven't yet received fully and consolidated and cemented this level called ben chorin, called the higher person. And that will give us some insight into as to why the breaking of the luchos just before the Jewish people got them was such a trauma, was such a tragedy. And in fact, it says everything. We don't even talk about the making of the Egel on the 17th of Tammuz. We're talking about the breaking of the luchos because we were that close to having been vouchsafed that higher form of living, but we didn't keep ourselves in check. We didn't maintain ourselves in the state that the luchos could then consolidate that state. And the truth is, says Maharal, if that would have placed us beyond, so to speak, beyond the reach of evil, we can perhaps understand why it was such a difficult situation, the whole thing with the Egel, with all the panic and confusion and very, very strong pulls towards the Egel. From a certain point of view, one could say, this is the last bid of evil. Meaning, if it's not today, he's finished in the way that we know. that we're familiar with the concept of evil, because once we get the luchos, we're safe, so to speak. Once we've received the luchos, which are engraved on the heart, Torah becomes engraved on our heart, and we're beyond reach of evil, effectively. So all eyes are on the receiving of the luchos, and that's why there's almost, so to speak, such an upsurge of evil. It's the final push, and we fell. But that gives us a sense of why it was such a tragic occasion, 17th of Tammuz. And there it lay. There matters lay. And we could have had the luchos, and they were broken, and we didn't get them, and everything that they represent, we don't have it. But then we got it. Because part of the rehabilitation and part of the reconciliation of the Jewish people with Hashem through their tshuva and through the month of Elul and through everything that went with that, culminating on Yom Kippur, is that we got new luchos. And by now, we appreciate what it means to receive new luchos. It means we have the ability to touch that madrega again of Ben Chorin. But there is one difference, and that is the heart. And the tablets of stone represent the heart. Who prepares the heart? In this respect, the second luchos were not the same as the first. In terms of the writing, they were the same. The writing for the first luchos, Michtav Elokim Hu. Hashem says to Moshe, I will write on the second luchos just like I wrote on the first. The writing is the same. The message is the same. But who prepares the heart? The first set of luchos, Hashem prepared it. All we needed to do was maintain ourselves, but we didn't need to rise to that level. We just needed to be sure not to fall from it, which we did. Because it says, V'haluchos ma'ase Elokim heima. The first set of luchos were also made by God. And that means that the heart, represented by the luach, had our heart had been prepared by Hashem. We just needed to be sure not to lose it. But the second luchos, as we know, and as we read on the Tanis Tzibor and the Parshas Kisisa, Hashem says to Moshe, "Psal lachashnei luchos." You need to prepare the luchos. You need to carve out the stone. And what does that mean? It means if the stone represents the heart, that madrega is waiting, but it's not a given anymore. You need to attain it. You need to prepare. When Moshe needs to carve out the luchos to receive Hashem's writing, it means, and the luchos represent the heart, it represents the idea that the Jewish people now need to carve out their heart. They need to prepare. And what does it mean to prepare? It could mean many things, but first and foremost, it means that the Jewish people need to develop a sense of idealism and purity and inspiration, whereby that's what they bring to learning Torah. They do not naturally approach Torah. The Torah will not naturally be etched on their heart. They need to purify their heart through positive character traits, through every good midah. And that's the carving of the heart. That's what the Jewish people bring. And if they do, then Hashem is prepared to write on it. And then you have that madrega of engraved Chorus al Haluchos. And that is full Matan Torah. It turns out that Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, which is really our relationship with Hashem through His Word, in the fullest sense of the word, is only true when we learn Torah like the engraving on the luchos. But you need to prepare your heart for that engraving to happen. And therefore, if for the full Matan Torah we need a pure heart, we can now understand the confluence of the two things that happened on Yom Kippur. Number one, we received Slicha and Kapara. That means we were reset. And number two, we got the second Luchos. Of all days of the year, we're kind of busy on Yom Kippur. That's the day you need to receive the second set of Luchos. Couldn't there be like another time? Yom Kippur is the day to receive the second Luchos. Because the second Luchos are about, you've got to bring your heart to learning Torah. You've got to bring your heart at its purest. Your heart will never be purer than on Yom Kippur. And that's why it's the day where the second luchos can be launched and the aspiration towards those madrigas can happen. And thus we understand how the second set of luchos, it's part and parcel. Yom Kippur is not just, quote unquote, it's not just a day of forgiveness. It's also a day of purity, as we say, ki vayom hazeh yichaper aleichem letaher eschem. There's two separate things, Rav Soloveitchik discusses at length, as do many others. Yichaper aleichem is your account vis-a-vis averus. But to have a person's account wiped away, but their heart remains the same as it was beforehand, that's not yet the full impact of Yom Kippur. Yichaper aleichem is to remove averus, to wipe them away. Lechaper means to wipe away. But then the taher eschem, to purify the heart. We are never more eligible to make a go of receiving Torah in the way that it should be received than on Yom Kippur, and thus it becomes a day of Matan Torah. And so, I submit that as much as we said, we do not refer to it in the davening, but to be aware of it and what it represents from a certain point of view, the way that we learn Torah from this point onwards, from Matzah Yom Kippur onwards, is essentially the legacy of the way the Yom Kippur allows us to receive the Torah. And that's something worth protecting. So those are some words with regards to the lesser discussed matter of the Luchos Shniyim and the Luchos in general, which I believe is most valuable. And from here, let us come to talk about Yom Kippur itself. And as we mentioned, the pasuk of the central pasuk, one could say, and there are many, but ki vayom hazeh yichaper lechem letaher eschem mikol chatoseichem lifnei Hashem titaru. And that final phrase, lifnei Hashem titaru, is an interesting phrase because it seems to have been stated already. Yichaper lechem letaher eschem, Hashem will purify you, and then it reiterates lifnei Hashem titaru. What does that add? It sounds like it's restating that you shall be purified before Hashem. Rabbeinu Yonah, in his famous work, Shari Tshuva, on Tshuva, states in two places, actually, that the final words, Lefnei Hashem Titaru, are a mitzvah. So far, everything is a haftocha, an assurance. Hashem will atone for you and purify you. But those final words, Lefnei Hashem Titaru, they're a mitzvah. Rabbeinu Yonah is of the opinion there is a special mitzvah, a distinct and unique mitzvah of doing tshuva on Yom Kippur, aside from the general mitzvah of doing tshuva the rest of the year. The source is the words, Lefnei Hashem Titaru. And says Rabbeinu Yonah, I'll prove to you that it's a mitzvah. It has to be a mitzvah, because what's the alternative? It's a haftacha, it's an assurance. We know from Chazal that there is no assurance that we will be purified from all sin on Yom Kippur. Why do I say that? The Gemara in the end of Maseches Yuma discusses the famous Chiluke Kapara, the divisions of Kapara, the tiers or hierarchy of Kapara. And briefly, there are four, because there's different levels of severity of sin. The Gemara says if a person neglected to do a positive mitzvah, everything's relative here, but that's the mildest, he can do tshuva and get kapara straight away. He doesn't leave until he gets kapara. What if he violates a negative prohibition? It's more stringent. So he does tshuva and then Yom Kippur finishes. So in other words, Yom Kippur can end things for level two. But there's higher levels. What if they're very severe sins, like those that carry the penalty of karis or misas bezdin? So the Gemara says Yom Kippur is not enough. The person will need to undergo Yisurim, what's called, suffering, in whatever form. And if it's level number four, Chilul Hashem, which is the worst of the worst, he's not going to get kapar until he dies. So you see, says Rabbeinu Yonah, Chazal are informing us that Yom Kippur, it's part of a hierarchy of kapara, and it only deals with what we're calling level two. But level three and above is not dealt with in Yom Kippur. And therefore, you cannot explain that the words Lefnei Hashem Titaru are an assurance, because there is no such assurance. Not for everything. Rather, it's a mitzvah. In other words, you need to see to it that you purify yourselves. The kapara will come when it comes. Now, there is another approach here. There is a well-known statement of the Gemara, which talks about what happens to averus when people do tshuva. Do they go away? Does anything happen to them? And there are two conflicting statements. The one says that intentional sins become like unintentional sins. Zidonos nasu kishkogos. That's one statement. Okay, so now we know. It's still there, but it's the sting has been taken out of it, and its intention has been taken out of it. Okay. But the other statement says, and this I believe is quite a well-known statement, Gedola tshuva, how great is tshuva, she zidonos nasu kizichuyos. That they become mitzvahs. Now, that takes some understanding. We can somehow understand how an intentional can become unintentional. Perhaps you're through regret at the time of tshuva, one is able to somehow retroactively retrieve the intention from the sin. That itself is a chiddush, but at least you can describe it. But to say that an aveir becomes a mitzvah, I don't know. I mean, that's quite a thing to say. But then the Gemara says, well, which is it? Did they become like shogeg or become like mitzvahs? Two conflicting statements. Says the Gemara, it depends what's the motivation for tshuva. Because there's two types. There's what's called tshuva meyira, tshuva out of fear, and tshuva me'ava, tshuva out of love. If it's out of fear, so then it's the lesser effect. It becomes like a shogeg. But if it's tshuva me'ava, it becomes like a mitzvah. The question is, we still don't understand how this works. We have labels now. I know there's something called tshuva me'ava. I still don't understand how it can make an aveira into a mitzvah. I'd like to understand. I'm not complaining. I'd like to understand. I will accept it. But I'd like to understand also. And the Mefarshim explain. And really we need to understand, to preface, what is tshuva out of love? It sounds so lofty. It's practically then unattainable. Tshuva out of love. Why is this person doing tshuva? He loves Hashem so much. Well, why is he doing so many aveiras if he loves Hashem so much? Like, where did this come from? This newfound love that he has by Hashem, and that's how he's doing tshuva. That's a madriga, and it's not really his madriga because he's busy trying to do tshuva. So he's in the trenches doing tshuva, and in the clouds there's this idea called love of God, and never the twain shall meet. And so basically it's inaccessible, and therefore unhelpful. What is tshuva me'ava? Says the Tzlach, that is the Node of Yehuda in his drashas of the Tzlach. There are two reasons really why a person would want to do tshuva. The first is because he doesn't want to get punished. It's from a certain point of view self-interest. I mean, it's just him. He preferred to be in a state of not being punished than as opposed to yes being punished. And tshuva can help, so he takes it. But the second motivator is that he doesn't want to be detached from Hashem. He doesn't want to be nowhere. He wants to be somewhere. And the somewhere to be is back together with Hashem. Says the Tzlach, the first type of tshuva is tshuva from fear. He fears punishment. He just wants to escape punishment. But he has no notion of getting closer to Hashem. And therefore his tshuva can help. But the second is really, he looks at himself and says, I'm nowhere. I'm drifting. I'm disconnected. I don't want to be disconnected. I want to reconnect. And on the contrary, his sorry state is actually launches him back to Hashem, which allows us to view all the wrong things that he did as basically precursors to this mitzvah called tshuva, of reconnecting. And thus we say that aveiros can become like mitzvahs. In a similar vein, but we already see that the idea of tshuva me'ava, tshuva out of love, is very accessible, meaning it's been given a working definition as opposed to some esoteric, elusive definition. It's tshuva to reconnect. I have seen three mefarshim independently who state the same chiddush. They are the Chida in his Sefer Midbar Kedemos, Rabbi Yitzchak Yochanan Spector in the introduction to his Shelus Tshuvas Nachla Yitzchak, and the Minchas Chinuch in Mitzvah Shin Samach Dalet. Each of these Mefarshim come to exactly the same conclusion, and that is the entire, what we're calling hierarchy, of different levels of Averis and Yom Kippur, it works for some but not for others, like the Gemara says. That's only true if a person does the lower level of tshuva, called tshuva out of fear. Because if he does tshuva out of fear, there's still something left, and depending on the severity, Yom Kippur can work for some and not for others. But if a person does tshuva out of love, as we've defined it, and there's nothing there anymore, so then nothing needs to work, nothing needs to happen anymore. If it becomes a mitzvah and there's no aveira anymore, so tshuva mi'ava can basically override all four levels, and a person can get kapara for all of them. It's a big chiddush. But now we understand why, if we go back to the pasuk, which says "Vayomazei chaper lechem," and then it concludes "Lefnei Hashem titaru," and Rabbi Yonah says it can't be a promise, not for everything, but say these achronim, it can, because if you do tshuva in the right way, it can be for everything. Lefnei Hashem titaru. And I think the more we look at Yom Kippur, the more we will see that not only, quote unquote, not only is it about tshuva, but it's about tshuva me'ava. There's something in the atmosphere of Yom Kippur where it's not just, and again I use the term advisedly, it's not just doing tshuva, but it's tshuva me'ava. We see that our prelude to vidui is this incredible piyut, where we just basically say to Hashem, you know, we're yours, you're ours, and we say that like eight different ways, and that's how we approach tshuva. As if to say, we're together, for better or for worse. For Hashem is better. We're the worse. But we're together. Anu mami recha, ata mami reinu, we're this, you're this, and so we've got to get back together. I mean, we can't just stay apart any longer. And Hashem has designed the day that we get back together. And that's why all kehillas, they sing this piyut. And then they go on to sing the vidui, which is the most counterintuitive thing one could imagine. Because vidui is not a time for singing. I mean, it's not the jolliest of tunes, but it's a song. Because it is a song. Because it's a song of getting back together. That's the atmosphere. That's the atmosphere that pervades throughout Yom Kippur. And if I may close with a fascinating observation, which is really from the Rosh. Yom Kippur is about coming back to Hashem with love. And it's about doing tshuva out of love. And it begins with love on Hashem's part. How so? There is a mitzvah which is called eating on the day before Yom Kippur. Once a year, it's a mitzvah from the Torah to eat. We like to stay in practice throughout the course of the year. But it is a mitzvah. And as mitzvahs go, it's the most unusual thing. Because is it not correct that we probably would be eating? I mean, we are Jewish, right? We would be eating and drinking if there's a fast tomorrow, even if we hadn't been told. So what's behind this mitzvah telling us to do something that we know to do by ourselves? Says the Rosh, it's an act of love. Who tells you to eat when you're eating anyway? Right? Someone who loves you, right? Your parent, or right? That's their job, to tell you to eat when you're already eating, because it's because they love you. Are you eating? Are you eating enough? That's what Hashem is saying. Why? Because that's the message that He wants to project before we enter Yom Kippur, to make sure that we enter Yom Kippur in that way. If you approach Hashem on Yom Kippur for kapara, and the very same Hashem that you're asking for forgiveness is the one who sent you a message yesterday asking if you'd eaten enough, you're okay. You know you're okay. You've got to use the day properly, but you know if you do, Hashem wants it to work and for us to get back together. So these, I believe, are the atmospherics of Yom Kippur. And the more we appreciate it, Mitzvah Hashem, the better use we'll make of it. And this Yom Kippur should be Keitz Mechila for everyone. It should be a year of Gemar Chasima Tova, Lechala, Fratvashah, Besiris, Tovas, Yeshuas, and the Chomus Bekarov.